This interview was recorded for the International Bomber Command Centre Digital Archive, which owns the copyright for this performance.
This interview is being conducted for the International Bomber Command Centre. The interviewer is Andrew Panton. The interviewee is Hugh Rogers. Mr. Rogers was one of the film cameramen on board a specially modified Lancaster from 463 Squadron Royal Australian Air Force that filmed the sinking of the Tirpitz on November the 12th, 1944. The interview is taking place at Bristol on the 9th of April 2015.
I recall two memorable days 70 years ago. The 11th and the 12th of November 1944. On the morning of the 11th, I was instructed to report to headquarters of Bomber Command at High Wycombe. That surprised me because people like me didn't go to headquarters at Bomber Command. And also, I'd only recently been posted to the film production unit, which I now served. In the event, two cameramen reported at headquarters. The first, Flight Lieutenant Loftus of the Canadian Air Force, and secondly, myself, Flying Officer Rogers, RAF, of the film unit. We were briefed standing at a small, very small table in a very large room. We were both members of the number one film production unit, RAF, at that time. We were told at this briefing that we were to bomb the giant German battleship Tirpitz moored in the Arctic, and that we were to join the main force of Lancasters at the RAF base in Nosimuth, Scotland. We were briefed on the very precise route to be taken to reach the Arctic base of the Tirpitz. It was explained to us that following the bombing, the main force would fly west and return to Scotland. The camera Lancaster, which we should be flying, would fly south and return directly to Waddington, so the film could be transported to London by road, processed, and as soon as possible, the pictures distributed. The propaganda value was important to the Allies, and it was thought would be devastating to the German population morale. Late on the 9th of the 11th, our Australian pilot, Flight Lieutenant Buckham, completed the first part of the operation, flying Lancaster HD-399 to RAF Nosimuth, which is near Inverness, Scotland. HD-399 was a Lancaster of the Australian Squadron 463, manned by an all-Australian crew other than us two cameramen. The aircraft had been modified for our special requirement. The first turret, had the guns removed, which were replaced with a mounted IMO 200-foot camera. In the fuselage area, the mid-upper turret with guns had been removed and the fuselage repaired, so that the two areas in the fuselage were then available for the second cameraman. The opened panel at the rear of the bomb bay gave a vertical sighting, and a second sight on the door edge to the starboard side of the fuselage, the top half of which opened at the time of filming, hence the requirement of my electrical heated inner suit. I learnt that the temperature at my station was -19°C and confirmed my view that I'd drawn the short straw. To sustain our 15-hour flight, we did not have a tall boy bomb loaded, but there was a large red fuel tank fitted in the space above the bomb bay. It contained about 80 tons of fuel, which I rested on during the flight. My abiding dramatic memory of the short time at Nosimuth was being in a badly lit barn-like room with Wing Commander Tate giving his last remarks to the 19 pilots of 617 Squadron. We were all standing in a group around Tate. I was standing at the back. He emphasized the importance of the prescribed course, which had been designed to avoid detection by the enemy. Over the North Sea, the course was to be at 1,500 feet, and this was to be maintained until the Norwegian coast was approached. So, in the early hours of Sunday, the 11th of November, there was a shattering noise as the engine started up in preparation for a 3M takeoff. The course was to be across northeast across the North Sea. Round about 7 o'clock in the morning, we changed course directly east when we approached the snow-covered mountains of Norway. We had been flying at about 1,500 feet across the North Sea, but the height was then maintained to cover the mountains, and we flew direct west into Sweden, where we turned north so that we could follow the boundary between Norway and Sweden at an altitude which would not expose us to the German radar. Once we had crossed the mountains, we then reduced altitude to a reasonably low level. We then had to fly north all along the route between Norway and Sweden until we reached the assembly point at Lake Torneå-Trask, east of Narvik, some 100 miles from Tromsø. In those northern latitudes, the daylight comes late, and I remember, as it got daylight, climbing over the central spar of the aircraft and going into the cockpit. Now, I was very impressed looking out of the cockpit, but even at that early hour, I could see the path that we were to take. All the lakes were covered by small lenticular clouds. These saucer-like clouds could have been used by the observer to mark his route north to Narvik. That was another of my abiding memories. When all the aircraft had reached the lake, Tate fired very lights, at which point all the aircraft then assembled into their battle station and followed Tate on the route to Tromsø. As all the aircraft were assembling into position over the lake, we had all gained height to 12,000 feet. Now, at this height, we were able to cross the mountain into the field where the Tirpitz was moored. Now, as we crossed the mountain, we were some 20 miles from the Tirpitz, and it was a mere small speck at that distance, and of course it was in reverse. We were small specks to the Tirpitz. Now, we know later that it caused consternation on the Tirpitz, not expecting us. They suddenly realized that they should call for help. And this they immediately did, apparently, so I learnt later, but there was no response to the call for help from the Messerschmitts. Soon after we were spotted by the Tirpitz, they assembled their gun positions, and their enormous guns, the 15-inch guns, which fired shells of 1 ton, took a few seconds to get to elevation, but in that time they realized that we were too high for the big guns firing 1 ton shells could reach us. But the shells were exploding ahead of us and slightly below us. Now, in our film Lancaster, they were close enough to cause some vibration and movement of the plane. Now, we had to hold the camera steady in spite of that movement. I think we achieved this. Of course, as we got closer to the Tirpitz, the smaller AK-AK guns started, and actually it was, I presume, because of the panic on board the ship, they were not too accurate. As the operation developed, John Loftus, lucky chap, was in the front turret, and he was able from the front turret to swing the turret round and track the first tall boys being dropped from the aircraft. I couldn't see that, but I was able then to go from the side position and film the first few bombs exploding around the ship. As I was working through that open space over the door, I could feel myself getting colder, but I wasn't distracted from what I was doing. But I could see the ship being hit. I could see the steam and the smoke coming up. And I could see, especially, I remember at the time it impressed me, what had happened to the guns on the island when the tall boy landed on the island at the starboard side of the operation. After the last aircraft had gone, I remember walking up or crawling up to the cockpit and looking out of the cockpit, and the pilot had dived to the starboard, to the right, and he was at about 5,000 feet by the time he finished, and we could see all the smoke and steam, and then he immediately turned on a course which we left because we were going back to Waddington and the rest of the force had gone west to Scotland. But much to our surprise, as we started our course to Waddington, the rear gunner shouted out to the skipper that he could see the Tirpitz turning over. So the pilot turned the aircraft to the starboard so we could see, but the pilot was on the other side, sitting on the other side, and he couldn't see it. So in order to see it, he dipped the starboard wing and again lowered his altitude, and we could see in the distance that by that time, strangely enough, all the smoke and the steam seemed to have gone, or there was a haze over the aircraft, and you could see that it was upside down. Now, I can't remember how quickly it was done, but the pilot knew that there was a squadron of Messerschmitts. We didn't know the Germans had been informed by radar, but it was time to get out. So from that time on, we kept on our course back to Waddington. So after that unforgettable operation, we headed south across the seas, Norwegian Sea, the North Sea, and down to Waddington. And after a flight of close on 15 hours, where we were met by Jim in his car, who collected the film as soon as possible, because he was taking it to London to be processed. Now that was on the Prime Minister, I believe Prime Minister's instruction, to get the film out developed as soon as possible for propaganda reasons, and also he thought the Prime Minister expected it to devastate the morale of the German people, because Hitler had always told them that the Tirpitz was unsinkable. And once again, 617 Squadron and 9 Squadron had proved Hitler wrong.